Support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Tracy Ray from the employment law firm of Baron Liebman. Tracy says that OPB sponsorship is a great way to support the community and connect with Baron Liebman's clients.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, April 12th. Sometimes it feels like the housing crisis this state is grappling with is relatively new. And without a doubt, it's gotten much worse and harder to solve in recent years. Some ways to help the unhoused, like tiny house villages, date back decades in Portland. And today, one of the city's oldest homeless communities, Right to Dream 2, is facing some financial challenges, even as the city is all in on the tiny house model. Welcome to the podcast. I'm OPB politics reporter Lauren Dake.
I'm OPB Portland politics reporter Alex Zielinski.
And I'm OPB politics and government reporter Bryce Dole.
Alex, you visited the City of Portland's largest outdoor shelter, which sits on a piece of city-owned property called Clinton Triangle. Could you set the scene here for a moment? What did you see when you visited?
Yeah, I visited a couple times in late February and early March. What I saw was an industrial lot that was somewhat transformed into a neighborhood of these little shed-like sleeping pods, 160 pods in total, and each one is about 10 by 10 feet and has space for a bed and storage inside. There's heating, there's AC. You know, I've been to many different outdoor shelters in Portland, sometimes called, you know, tiny home villages, and this one felt different. Maybe it was because the days I went, it was kind of overcast and cloudy and cold, but there just weren't many people out and about in the public spaces, and it didn't feel very warm or friendly or kind of well-used. It definitely feels pretty new still. But big picture, it's a large cement-covered lot with a bunch of these sleeping pods, fenced-in area for dogs, people can bring their pets there, and an indoor space where people can watch TV and meet with their staff assigned to them to help connect them to services and resources.
And the shelter is considered low barrier. Remind us what that means and also why it matters.
Yeah, so it means a lot of restrictions that may be in place in other shelters, like no pets, no couples staying together, those aren't there. It also doesn't require sobriety for people staying there. So while people aren't allowed to use drugs or drink in public spaces there, they can in the privacy of their sleeping pods. This can be a big deal in the work of getting people living outside on the path to housing. Because if someone wants help, but they're told that they have to get rid of their dog or go cold turkey on a drug they're hooked on, you know, that's a huge disincentive. It keeps a lot of people from even considering help. Another interesting aspect of the Clinton Triangle shelter is the work staff do to keep people alive. Since it's well known that people are using drugs in their sleeping pods, staff regularly knock on people's doors to conduct these wellness checks. And this system has led to staff reversing dozens of overdoses at the shelter. They say no one has died from an overdose there, which is pretty significant compared to the number of ODs that take place in the streets or in more isolated areas in Portland.
I imagine that also can make it hard for people to stay sober who are living at Clinton Triangle. Did you talk to some people who had those type of stories?
Yeah. I spoke with a number of them, including this woman named Charlene Brown, who has been staying at the shelter since July. She overdosed a couple months ago after taking meth laced with fentanyl, and staff had to use the overdose-reversing drug naloxone on her 6 times to save her. It was, a big wake-up call and inspired her to get sober and work towards getting into permanent housing. She goes to these weekly recovery meetings where she's told that the key part to staying sober is removing the people, the places, and the things that remind her of her addiction. So that's hard for her to do. Here's how she put it.
I'm living in the place where I OD'd. You know, I'm freaking surrounded by the people that are using, and I can't make them stop.
So I spoke with a number of other people who currently use drugs like meth and fentanyl, who told me that, like Charlene, they want to get sober, but it feels impossible for them to do with the shelter because it's kind of all around them. So these folks, they really want to move into housing where they believe they can get and stay sober, that is kind of the first step to making that move. But that's become another big problem because of money.
Yes, let's talk about money because it always becomes an issue. People are not met to live in these pods forever. The city and the county have promised help to move them to permanent housing, but it sounds like that has hit a snag.
Yeah, you're right. So the shelter opened in July, and in October, the city and county received nearly $4 million in state dollars, meant specifically for moving people out of shelter and into housing. That money essentially covers up to a year's rent for people who are ready for a move and comes with support from nonprofits to ensure that they are on a path to keep paying rent once that year is up. Just over 100 people moved into housing through that program since October. But then in January, that funding just completely dried up. The whole cycle ground to a halt. And for 3 months, most people at the Triangle who were seeking housing were told that there was no money left to help them. Only last week did the county identify enough money to move about 52 households from the shelter into apartments, which is great news for shelter residents, especially since a lot of them had begun to lose hope that they'd get a chance to move beyond the shelter. A number I talked with were even considering moving back to the streets. But this problem isn't totally resolved, right? It's kind of a Band-Aid. There's still no longer-term plan to fund housing for people exiting shelters like Clinton Triangle. There's, you know, a bigger budget discussion with the city and county that needs to go on to see what that could look like, you know, which understandably makes a lot of shelter residents still pretty uneasy. I spoke to a number who said that, you know, the uncertain funding model has really withered their trust in this program, and trust is key to these kind of program success.
Originally, the plan was to open 5 more of these shelters across the city. Is that still going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it is. We're being told it is. There's no time frame to get to that point. The city has really struggled to get property for these shelters to sit on. Right now, they have one additional spot identified, but they discovered the soil has some contaminant in it that has to be removed before anyone could even set foot on it. So that's a ways off. You know, Mayor Wheeler has really focused on establishing these shelters before he leaves office at the end of the year. So there is, I think, some urgency from his office to get these off the ground. There is a political drive there, but it's unclear when that will come to play.
Okay, we are going to pivot and talk about one of Portland's original communities for unhoused people. And maybe a little bit unfairly, we are going to ask OPB's newest politics reporter to talk about the history. Bryce, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the politics team.
It's great to be here.
So Portland has a long history of tiny house villages. One of those is Right to Dream 2, which has been around since 2011. It houses about 60 or 70 people at once, and for a long time, the camp was located at the gate to Chinatown. It often made front page news because politicians and neighborhood groups were battling over the camp. Multiple mayors struggled with where it should be located. But more recently, it's just sort of lived in relative obscurity. Bryce, you went to visit Right to Dream 2. Tell us about it.
Yeah, Right to Dream 2 is a community of tiny homes and shelters that sits between the Moda Center and the Willamette River in the Lloyd District. When I went there, there were about, you know, 20-ish people hanging around, but as many as 60 people can stay there each night, and as many as 100 people will come there to get help in one way or another each day. They get food and supplies and water and coffee, and residents are basically of all ages. Some people struggle with disabilities or mental health problems and addiction. Again, like Alex was saying, this is a low barrier shelter, which means that they don't have to be sober to stay there. And it's run by people who are unhoused. They stay there and they work there. And to them, this camp is a really critical place for some of the city's most vulnerable homeless people to get help every day.
And how is this camp funded?
The camp is a nonprofit organization, and it gets its funding in a whole bunch of different ways. This can be through grants, through donors, fundraisers. Sometimes it gets money from the city or from local nonprofits. Most recently, it was one of several groups that received funding to help open 3 city-sanctioned camps for unhoused people to shelter during the coronavirus. But that funding dried up. And the camp's treasurer basically told me that they have never had a consistent funding source. So this is likely not going to be the last time that they deal with the financial struggles that they've seen.
So what is the budget? I mean, how much money does it need to stay open? How much money does Right to Dream 2 have?
So not a lot. It runs on a shoestring budget. It basically needs money for things like bathrooms and garbage services and showers. Last year's budget was just over $60,000, and that amount has steadily increased over the years. When I began reporting on this camp, they had less than 2 months of operating revenue that was left. The main concern of a lot of people who were staying there was that if they ran out of money, they'd have to close the overnight shelter, and a lot of other people who would otherwise get help there would have to walk really long distances across the city to get help at other shelters.
Alex, let's turn back to you before we go. We just heard about the struggles of this one community that in many ways is the model that Portland is pursuing today with its shelters like Clinton Triangle. What does this say about how far the city has come and maybe how far it has to go still to address this crisis?
Yeah, well, I think a big step is that the city is now running these shelters that used to only be run by kind of scrappy nonprofits like Right to Dream or community organizations. I think, like Bryce mentioned, you know, the COVID pandemic really gave impetus to that. It got the city really involved in funding these programs since city leaders realized that people living outside were unable to social distance themselves, but also moving everyone into a mass indoor shelter wasn't the right response. And now it's becoming city and county policy. So there's a big change there. But that doesn't mean that the city and county have perfected any of this. Like I noted with the Clinton Triangle, they're still struggling to find a solid funding model or to even kind of create a plan to continue funding. And there's still debate among leaders over whether shelter investments are the right solution to our region's homeless crisis or if we should be investing and focusing on building more housing. It's this constant tug of war. But being able to standardize and streamline these larger outdoor shelters is key to keeping the cycle of moving people off the streets and into housing intact.
Thank you. Thanks. Let's leave the conversation there for today. Bryce and Alex, thank you both for your important reporting. Be sure to check out both of their stories and all of our political coverage at opb.org. This week's episode of OPB Politics Now was produced by Andrew Thien. Our audio engineer is Nalene Silva. Our music comes from Audio Network. We will be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Until then, thank you for your support and thank you for listening.
Politics Now and all of OPB's reporting in our communities are made possible by the support of our members. Do your part to help make it happen. Become a sustaining member now at opb.org/pod.